All right, let's do a shoot the shit episode. I'm done talking about plans. Except we're going to talk about our plans in the episode.
Back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am here with Tricky Dave Pescarella.
I'm dazed, dazed, and confused.
And we have Mr. Scott H. Gardner with us.
Hello, how's it going?
It's going pretty well, and I'm going to totally be very, very candid with our audience. I'm going to be transparent, as is the popular term of the day. Well, the way all these kids talk. How am I transparent if I have clothes? I mean, I'll tell you that we have been doing some soul searching. We are feeling a little burnt out. I don't mean to speak for everybody, but if I say something that you disagree with, please correct me, guys. And we were thinking about going on a hiatus. But when we talked about it, we feared that a hiatus would mean probably pod fading, that the chances of us not coming back increase dramatically by having a hiatus. So we have elected to continue doing the show, but to try and ease the pressures of everyday life and getting an episode out there and try and keep our batteries fresh and the episodes fresh, we've decided to change our schedule a little bit. Instead of doing a new episode every Saturday, we will endeavor to do a new episode every other Saturday. And on the Saturdays when we are not producing a new episode, we are going to publish what we will call classic bins. You know, starting at episode number one and working our way forward, I don't know if that will be inclusive of every episode. I'll probably do a listen to each one before I actually publish it. And if there are any that are incomplete or the sound quality is terrible or anything like that, we're probably going to skip over them and move on to something else. But since we had the problem with the website where some episodes didn't come over, where they didn't come over to Apple Podcasts, where they didn't go over to Spotify, I think this is a way to allow the audience to have access to earlier episodes and allow us to, again, kind of recharge our batteries and keep the episodes fresh, keep our energy level higher than if we're just pushing to just record for the sake of recording. Any thoughts, guys?
No, here's something.
They're not the highest paid podcasters and two true freaks for nothing. Right. I mean, you know, like I said, the whole idea is to keep ourselves at a higher energy level, which I think just the idea of kind of eliminating the pressure has given me a higher level of energy for tonight's talk. And tonight we're just planning on talking about, you know, just this is what we call a shoot the shit episode. And most of my talk, and obviously, you know, we're all going to have our chances to talk about different things, but most of it has to do with the fact that I took my annual trek down to Florida last week. And on the Friday that I was down there, we met for breakfast. It was myself, Dr. Bill, Al Sedano, Gene Hendricks, and my brother-in-law, Ken. We met for breakfast at Cracker Barrel, which is our usual meeting place. Al actually had family coming over, so he had to depart after breakfast. But then we went over to Urban Legend and spent quite a bit of time there. Hit a couple of the minor stores and Sound Exchange, and you know, did okay. I mean, got some good stuff. Urban Legend seems to be even a little bit more disorganized than it was. It seemed like he must have bought a bunch of collections since the last time I was there. And a lot of them haven't been integrated into his sets yet. So it's kind of what I find to be appealing about a comic store and what turns me off at the same time. I love being able to explore and find hidden treasures. But I also, when I have a want list that's so specific, I like to be able to say, okay, I'm in the A's now, then I'm in the B's, then I'm in the C's. And, you know, this was a little of each. And I did end up getting a decent number of books while I was there. I think the most significant thing was I completed my wants for the series of Thor. Now, factoring in that Thor started with issue 125, before that it was Journey into Mystery. I do not have all the Journey into Mysteries from 83 to 124. I have a decent number of them, but I certainly don't have all of them.
So you have
125. I have 125 to 400 solid.
Ooh.
I was missing two issues in that run, and I picked them both up at Urban Legend last week. And then what's that?
Any thought to going? Because, I mean, what are you, 102 issues, I think, from the end of volume one?
I think that's correct. I think it went to 502.
So any thought?
I go back and forth on it.
Because,
my biggest reason for not doing it is just volume and the amount of space it takes up to add another 102 issues. I give you total blame for this, but you already made me find room for 200 issues of Conan. Because I think I had like five or six of them. And then you were like, hey, Paul, look over here. They have some early Conan issues at a great price. Next thing I knew, I walked away with a bunch of them. And it was, well, I need issue 1 to 200 now. And just as an aside, I've completed that run as well.
So I was trying to remember. That's
200 issues.
Normally, I'm very good at this sort of thing, but I was blanking. I was trying to remember, where was Thor at issue 400? And so I just pulled up my cover gallery here, and I'm looking at the 400s. And granted, from about, it looks like about 460 through about 490, I think. It's rough stuff, and that is skippable. So about 30 issues you could easily skip. But I'm telling you, man, from 400, or actually about 401 through, I think it's pretty much right up to 460. That's the shit that got me into Thor. Because, I mean, now granted, you know, I take that back. What actually got me interested in Thor for the first time was the Simonson run, of course. But what made me read beyond that and actually get invested in the character beyond just the Simonson run, because, I mean, you could do just the Simonson run, walk away at the end of that and be like, okay, that's all the Thor I ever need. And that's kind of how I was. But then, back when, you remember when Walmart used to have like where the card section, like all that Yu-Gi-Oh and Pokemon shit in Walmart is today, back in the day, back in like, I guess this was like the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, I think they had like these, it was like a brick, but it was a, what do you call that when something's in like a hard metal, or I mean, I'm sorry, not hard metal, hard plastic case.
Well, that a casket.
Yeah, kind of like that. It was like a cat, but it was like a pack of comics. And I can remember them having like whole runs of Thor from the 400s. And it would be like, I'm not sure how many issues. I want to say it was something like six issues per thing, but they were all subsequent and it was all the same title. And for some reason, I picked one up one day, and I think it was the one, I'm almost positive it's the one with the Thor of the future, which I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to find what issue number that is, and I can't quite find it here. But I picked that up just out of pure, oh, it's 438. I picked that up out of pure curiosity because I loved the cover on it. And it's, art by Ron Frenz, who's one of my favorites, and stories by Tom DeFalco. So that whole run, just about that entire run, is DeFalco Frenz. And it just sucked me right back into Thor. And there's some good stuff in there. You've got, you know, Thor's battle with the Celestials, and, you know, where he eventually, you know, Eric Masterson comes in and takes over as Thor for a while, and all that stuff, you know, that split off and became Thunderstrike and all that. But I don't know. It has a classic feel to it, like the Lee Kirby stuff, without just aping that stuff. Kind of like what Byrne did when he came back and did FF, to where, you know, you could tell he was taking the title back to its roots type of thing. And that's how Thor felt under DeFalco Frenz to me. And so I would encourage you to at least sample that stuff before you make the commitment to, no, I'm done, you know, 400, I'm done, because you're missing some really quality. Even if you just went, you know, continued it just 60 more issues to 460, I mean, there's some quality stuff in there, some really, really good Thor stuff in there.
And once you get to 460, I mean, it's only 40 books to finish the whole thing.
You know. Well, I mean,
keep talking. In all fairness, I'll be right back in.
I mean, in all fairness, I have not read every issue between 460 and I'm trying to remember which issue. I think it's 491 is where, I don't remember who the writer was, but what's his name? Mike Deodato came in as artist. And I think, off the top of my head, I'm pretty sure that's where I discovered Mike Deodato, you know, for myself personally, and instantly fell in love with his art. And yeah, that's about a 10 issue stretch between 491 and the end of the series that was actually really solid, because I think they realized that the book had kind of tanked and it was shit. And a lot of times when a book gets to that point and they just let them do whatever the hell they want to, because they figure that's going to get canceled anyway, that's usually when some really good stuff, you know, some magic happens.
Sure,
and
that's what happened.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what happened with Thor right at the very end of Thor Volume 1, is it suddenly got really good again. But then unfortunately it got canceled in favor of, I think that's when they did Heroes Reborn or whatever. I think that's what the lead up was, if I remember right. So it was similar. You know, there were several books that same sort of thing happened, like Captain America, same thing. I mean, right at the very end of Captain America Volume 1, it suddenly got really freaking good, and then they canceled it. So, yeah.
But I've only read maybe the first 60 issues of Thor.
It's good stuff.
Well, the first 30 or so, they really lacked direction. It took them a while to,
yeah,
it was really, honestly, for me, I mean, you got some of his villains early on that became key, certainly Loki, obviously, but around the time when it became Thor, when it changed from Journey into Mystery to Thor, that's when it kind of hit its stride a little bit for me. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that was, to me, when Kirby started to really excel in some of his artwork.
Right.
That's like a lot of those, like there's like about a 50 issue run where you have some peak Kirby. So, you know, that's what really got me. And we see some of those issues on the old Marvel Superheroes cartoons too.
Yeah.
Which I love.
Well, you know me, I'm not the highest guy in the world on Kirby, but I love Kirby Thor. That Kirby Thor, my only regret with that stuff is I wish he had shit-canned, what's his name, Coletta earlier, because Coletta did him absolutely no favors on Thor, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
But once, no, who was the inker that they eventually brought in for Kirby on Thor? I forget. But once the better inker came in, then, I mean, that stuff's gold from that point on. But I can't remember who it was.
Offhand, I couldn't tell you. Yeah, so I also closed out my Conan run in that same trip. Then Ken kept saying he wanted to go to another store, which we didn't have time to squeeze in. And then he got us in a little bit of trouble that weekend, when, or that Monday, I think it was, when, you know, our wives were saying, oh, we want to go out and do something. We want to go do something. So let's go by the mall and do something. We pulled up in front of the mall. And he says, all right, girls, go in. Paul and I are going to this comic store. And then it was like, we'll be back in 2 hours. They were, I mean, you could have fried an egg on their heads. They were so annoyed. But we went to this place called We Love Comics. And I got a few good issues there, some good boys. It was the same kind of, you know, it was a much smaller store than Urban Legend. But, you know, he had some boxes there. He was like, I haven't even looked them over yet. I don't know what's in them. But if you want to look through them and see if there's anything, you know, you like, I'll give you a price. And, you know, he was obviously willing to work with us on the prices. And we, you know, I ended up spending more money than I expected going there. So that was nice to actually find a new comic store that I had never been to before that I could enjoy. One of the things that was key, or two of the things that were key, was we went on the Friday to the comic shop. Then on Saturday, we drove to Orlando where we went to Epic Universe. And I can't recommend that park highly enough. That was so awesome. There's four different worlds when you go in, and each one has an entryway to it. And it's just amazing because you walk through the entryway and then you are immersed in that world. You don't see any other part of the park. And I was most geeked out by the Dark Universe area, which is, you know, the Universal Monsters. They had a Frankenstein ride there that was amazing. With all of the different monster, you know, the different Universal monsters represented on it. I actually got into an argument with the Invisible Man while I was there. and one of my friends who came with us, who had told me beforehand, he said, yeah, he's very obnoxious. He said, but if you show him respect, he'll warm up to you. So I tried to suck up to the Invisible Man, but he wasn't having it. You know, he would start, you know, I'd say, oh, you know, I am impressed by your scientific work, blah, blah, blah. Oh, you are. And then I made a mistake of saying, would you mind posing for a picture? You know, my wife is there with a camera. And you asked about my work, and now you want a picture? What's wrong with you? Are you an imbecile? And he just starts going on and on. And you know, the problem is it was hard to keep from laughing. But that was very cool. It was just, you know, we went into, like, the restaurant there, and just everything is so laid out so well. And I think it started with the Harry Potter lands at Universal and Islands of Adventure, that Universal realized that if they make the park part of the adventure for you, and if they make the queue part of the adventure for you, you don't mind it so much if you walk out of there having only gone on a couple of rides. Because you just enjoy the whole atmosphere and being there all day. And that was where these four different lands really kind of come into play, because each one of them, you're immersed in that land once you walk through the portal. And I can't tell you how impressed I was with the place. You've been there now, haven't you? Or not yet?
No, I haven't. I lost my free admission to Universal. My son doesn't work there anymore, so I don't get in for free, so I'm gonna have to end up going on my own dime at some point. But he went several times before
and
I stopped.
I know working. You told me this, Freddie, and I have my senior moments where I forgot that you told me that you hadn't been there. But I like I said, I can't recommend it more highly enough. But then we stayed overnight in one of the Universal hotels, and that was really just to stay. You know, we were not really doing anything in the hotel. It was, you know, we slept there, and then we got up in the morning and had breakfast, and we were ready to go. When we had breakfast, we met up with Scott and his wife, which was really nice to manage to get together. It was an interesting thing staying at the Universal Hotel. At some point, our wives just got tired. They had enough. But since we were staying at the Universal Hotel, it was like, okay, you guys go back to the hotel. We're staying here. and at the end of the night, it was just fantastic because people were leaving, so the lines weren't so long. In the Dark Universe area, they had a Frankenstein ride that we waited an hour and a half to get on it early on. And the ride is awesome, just as an aside. But at 9 o'clock, an hour before the park closed, we walked right through and just got on. No wait whatsoever. And we did that on several rides. So that was really cool. So then, like I said, then we had breakfast with the gardeners, which was always enjoyable. But from there, Ken had been saying he had a surprise for me. And I had no clue what he was talking about, but he drove to a place called Deezerland. And it was basically, it's a car museum. And I'm not a huge car fanatic, but walking through, first of all, I was incredibly impressed with just the scope of it, how many different vehicles they had and how many historic vehicles they had, you know, celebrities' vehicles. They had Franklin Delano Roosevelt's car. They had just, you know, some cars that were just amazing. And they had, you know, they had different rooms. They had a room of German cars. They had a room of Italian cars. They had a room of English cars. And I was looking at all of that. And even as a non-car guy, it was still fascinating to see. But then they had the geek areas where they had the cars from Dukes of Hazzard. They had a whole room of Batman vehicles. They had a room of James Bond vehicles, and they had a room of different other movie vehicles. And I thought, okay, you know, this is why he wanted to show it to me. And I took a bunch of pictures. But then when we came out of there, there was an entire area dedicated just to James Bond with vehicles from every movie, including like Goldfinger's plane. I mean, it was a huge area. And then in the back, they had showcases of all sorts of James Bond paraphernalia and different, you know, memorabilia and all sorts of things. It was just an amazing thing. I don't know how long that place will be there, but I recommend that anyone who gets a chance, go see it. It was very, very cool. I posted a few pictures on our Bins Facebook page. Did I do it on the Facebook page or did I do it on just my, on my Facebook page? I'm not sure. I did it on the Bins page.
I did see them, but I don't remember where they were.
I'm going to take a look, but like I said,
I know you sent me some.
Very.
What was the name of the place?
Well, I knew you were in Deezerland.
Where? I was in the airport.
That's well, you where were I in Orlando. Most... No, you were not. You were not in the airport. You went home the day after I did.
But I didn't plan on it.
I feel like the I feel like the mother when the daughter gets the cat saved out of the tree in Superman. What did I tell you about lying and then I smacked Dave?
Haven't I told you to stop telling lies, smack?
So what did you do, Scott, after you had breakfast with Paul? What did you do then for the rest of the?
Yeah, what did you do?
I totally don't remember. Totally don't remember.
Didn't you make a stop somewhere?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I went over to the Coronado and met up with you. Oh, I forgot. Man, yeah.
That tells you how unmemorable.
You're not that memorable, Dave.
My visit was.
No, it tells me how senile I'm getting is what it tells me. No, we got to meet up for a bit at the resort that Dave was staying at. We were staying at Coronado Springs, and that was cool. Now, you'd stayed there before, right?
No, I'd never been there. No?
What'd you think?
Oh, it was really nice.
Yeah, I like that.
I thought it was beautiful.
It is. It's nice. I like that one.
We went up to the 16th floor where they have that, you know, open area that overlooks, you know, it's like Alexander, you know, overlooking his empire. Everything is owned by Disney as far as the eye can see.
That's got to be quite the view up there, I would imagine. I've not been up there myself.
It's an amazing view, I will say that.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go check that out sometime. I didn't know you could just go up there. I thought you could only go up there if you had a dining reservation.
Well, they have a restaurant up there. To the left is the restaurant. To the right, it's like a bar. Yeah, it was very nice.
Well, now I have to sneak up there sometime.
Tell them you know me. Yeah, but we were in and out.
Won't that get him kicked out?
It might. Now, our trip was like a really quick hit and run. We came to, you know, visit Teresa, who's working down there. Our plan was to come Saturday and go back on Tuesday. And, of course, due to circumstances beyond the control of anybody, we were stuck there an extra day. So,
now, was that all due to the shutdown and all that stuff?
The initial delay, I was so lucky. You know, we went to Epcot. That was the only park we went to. We went, I guess it was, what was it, Monday? Yeah, Monday we went to Epcot, just Teresa and I. And we went on a total of one ride, Guardians, which I'll be honest with you, Guardians is not for me.
Yeah.
Me neither, actually. And I get into... people don't like that I say that, but to me,
but
I
it's
like
not against the movie. Is
I don't like
spinning.
Yeah, I don't feel like Guardians was a theme ride. It's a roller coaster where they play old music. Just because you're playing old music doesn't make it Guardians.
So we got out of that.
Like I said, the Frankenstein ride at Universal is awesome because it's a theme ride, even though you're being bounced all over the place. But Guardians, no.
And we got
sorry
out.
To interrupt you, Dave. Go ahead.
We got out. We were going to have a little something to eat afterwards because I knew not to eat beforehand. And my wife calls and says, how are you making out? Have you heard anything? And I go, no, we should be good. I haven't heard anything. As soon as I hung up the phone, literally, I got, bing, your flight has been canceled. We can, you know, and, you know, this isn't our fault. We got a plane. We got a crew. We're ready to go. We'll either refund you your money or, you know, you could fly into maybe Westchester if you'd like or Albany because, you know, it's all right next door. So I had to spend the next hour trying to book on my phone, you know, a flight to get back, which was a day late now. Mm. And that's just the beginning of the event. My wife took care of the hotel. She, you know, went down to the front desk and came back saying, oh, you know, they'll let us stay another night, you know, as long as we're willing to pay, it's not a problem. The flight home now, the next day we get to the airport at 5:30 in the morning because, you know, with the shutdown, just in case you want to get through TSA, right? Maybe there's a long line. We get on the line as soon as we got online, right through. Plane was supposed to
leave. That
was
our experience as well.
Yeah, well, the plane was then
supposed to leave. Our flights were delayed, but the TSA was nothing.
At 8:05. An hour in, they told us, oh, there's going to be a delay. And then there was another delay. And then it was, okay, we have a mechanical problem. It's going to take 2 hours for the part to arrive and then 2 hours to install the part.
No, that's the part where I'm like, no, no, no. You're letting me the hell off this plane right now. Mechanical problems and me flying, that's not a thing that you put together. But I hear mechanical problems about an airplane. I'm like, no, let me the hell off this thing.
Nope. You know you're screwed when you're sitting at the gate for the delay and they go, oh, we're going to move you to another gate. Now you know it's a big problem. But for your inconvenience, we're going to give you a $15 credit that you could go buy something in the airport, you know, like a bottle of water.
I was just going to say, what the hell are you going to buy for $15 at the airport? Kleenex?
If you put another dollar in, you could get a bagel and a soda. That's what you can get at the airport. So yeah, we spent a total of 11 hours on the way home.
Holy shit.
It was almost as long as the trip to Florida. And because Scott knew we were coming, he made sure that the weather was, you know, 4 degrees below zero, just like here.
Yeah, how the heck did that happen?
Hey, I was prepared. Which I'm shocked because usually my wife's the one who's prepared. When we came to the airport from New York, I brought my coat. I took it down to Florida with me. So I was prepared.
See, normally I would make fun of you for something like, who the hell brings a quote to Florida? But yeah, that was, you were here at the one time that you would actually need it.
And as soon as I left, I bet it got warm, right?
It was 86 today.
There you go.
November, and it's 86. It's crazy. Yeah. But yeah, our cold snaps never last for very long. That's why I personally welcome them when they come, because I know they're not going to last very long. It's a nice reprieve, because everybody is looking at you. Everybody I work with is looking at me. I'm still wearing shorts, you know, and they're like, aren't you freezing? I'm like, no, I have memories of August to keep me warm. Thank you very much.
Well, also, you grew up when there were like 4 feet of snow in the winter.
Yeah, exactly. The Floridian concept of cold is absolutely laughable to me.
It's like upstate, you have 4 feet of snow. Oh, that's a delayed opening.
I mean, cold to me is like 20 below. That's friggin' cold. 30, 40 degrees positive is not cold. I can deal with it.
Yeah, I'm in total agreement.
But down here, if it dips below 80 degrees, everybody's freezing to death and bundling up.
Like, and the joke is most of the people there came from up here.
Yeah, that's what I don't get. Yeah, I know. It's true.
This
I get
cold?
That question every single – I don't think there's been a single working day in the 15 years I've been with them that I haven't been asked by somebody, so are you from here? I'm like, nobody's from here. Nobody is from Florida. Where does this question come from? That's what I want to know.
What about Florida, man?
It's an icebreaker question. I get it. You know, you're just trying to make conversation. But seriously, though, I mean, I wish people would stop and think about the questions that they ask and how they sound. Because when you ask somebody, oh, so are you from Florida? You don't sound very smart, because nobody's from Florida. There hasn't been anybody born in this state since 1856, for Christ's sake. I mean, everybody's from up north.
The people that were from Florida got moved to Oklahoma, I believe.
Oh, shit. I'm not touching that. That's fucked up. Not that you're wrong, but, oh, man.
Well, I was told when I talked about snowbirding again, I was told basically in like the John Candy voice, oh, no, the state is closed. The moose at the door should have told you.
How would you feel if you got to Florida and it was closed?
Hey, as long as I made it in, they can close the door now. That's the funny thing, though, is – you know, everybody down here now is freaking out because of the shit that's going on in New York. I don't want to get political, but I just, you know, so there's all this stuff going on in other places, New York being one of the big ones, where there's sudden mass exoduses, and everybody here in Florida is freaking out about it. We're freaking closed, and you no more New Yorkers. I'm like, you assholes are from New York. What are you talking about? So, yeah,
Just, you know, to put a point on that, if I may, the people who are saying they're going to move to Florida, do you think they're the ones who put the guy in charge who's in charge?
No, I don't. At least I hope not. So, I mean,
it's like you got what you wanted. Why would you move?
Yeah, I mean, there's that fear, too, is, you know, I've been seeing those bumper stickers more and more often of, you know, don't California my Florida and stuff like that. So, I mean, I get that, but I don't know. We're getting dangerously close to political shit now.
That ends the political portion of our program.
God. So I want to know.
You guys been reading?
That's what I want to know. Oh, I wanted to, what are you guys into? What are you reading these days?
Dave is pulling out his recent reading book.
Hold on. For those of you who don't follow my posts on the group, I've been reading a ton of 70s Batman. Batman Detective, Batman Family. I'm halfway through the Joker series, all in publication order. and I am still reading the Golden Age Superman. As I mentioned, you know, prior to us coming on the air, I looked at my reading project and I said to myself, shit, I'm not going to live long enough to read all these books cover to cover. So I've limited it to my Superman interests, pretty much. I really don't care what Congo Bill was doing with whom and where, so I've eliminated it. But that's, you know, I've read reading a lot of the, you know, current DC stuff, which I am buying, because I suffer from that completist disease that I have to have every Superman, you know, to keep the numbering up, even though the Superman title, they keep renumbering. So that's been my reading project, but I am enjoying the hell out of the Batman stuff.
See, I am so jealous because that is a reading project I desperately want to do, is right in that era that you're in right there. You know, the beginning of like the Neil Adams, Denny O'Neill stuff, you know, that era. Because I'm trying to fill those issues in. I decided I wanted to go back to a particular like start point and go forward from there. And it's not really hard as far as, I mean, it's not a lot of issues. It's just that stuff has gotten really pricey. But while I was up in Georgia recently, I went back. So we, you know, my wife's mom was in a bad way recently, and then she eventually passed, unfortunately. So we had multiple trips up to Georgia in the past few months, and one of the trips when we were up there, I got a chance to go to, longtime listeners to Two True Freaks will get a kick out of this because they probably remember me talking back in the day before I moved to Orlando, you know, the Orlando area here in Florida, about going to the West Georgia flea market, because I got some great scores there back in the day. It's where I bought my four-player Captain America and the Avengers arcade machine that I restored for $25. I bought a friggin' arcade. I mean, how often does that ever happen in your life? It's where I bought Green Lantern number 40 that we covered not long ago on the show. So, you know, it was neat to finally go back there after all these years. And, you know, all these years away, and it really hadn't changed a whole hell of a lot other than all of a sudden it basically has like a comic shop right in the middle of it. Now, I say comic shop, but you have to picture it's a comic shop through a flea market filter. So it's basically like a giant flea market booth, but it's all comics. And the guy had some amazing stuff. I mean, some really, really top-notch books. But the problem is that he just chain smoked the worst cigars the entire time while I was trying to look at the books. And I'm very, I don't know what the word is, but I'm very susceptible to that. You know, it's like my throat closes up. I mean, when I was a kid, I was a really bad asthmatic, not so much anymore, but if I'm exposed to the right triggers, it's like my throat closes. I just can't friggin' breathe. And this guy's just puffing, you know, stogies the entire time. And it was the worst. It was like he was smoking a cat turd or something. They just had the worst stink to him. So, you know, I'm trying to look, but after a time, it's like, I can't hang with you anymore, dude. You're killing me. But you don't want to say that to somebody because he was a nice guy. It's just, I couldn't be around all this smoke. So I bought a few things and bailed, but one of the boxes he had let me look through when I was, you know, cause he asked me what I was looking for. And I told him, you know, the sweet spot of the stuff I'm looking for these days. So he let me look through this box of like new acquisitions that he hadn't gotten around to pricing yet. And in there was a Detective 400, which has long been on my want list, but that book is stupid expensive.
What are they asking?
Well, he was asking $100 for it.
Jeez.
And I thought, damn, that's actually a really good price. It was in really good condition, but I was just like, I just can't pull the trigger on 100. I mean, I'm still, you know, I'm still old school. I got to find things on the cheap. So I let it go. But
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll send you a digital copy for 50.
But it, you know, it was galling me. So when we were back up there the last time, I got a chance to get together with my older boy, Scotty, who he lives up in that area. And so we got together, and he hadn't been to that flea market since he was a kid. So we went together, and we went back, and that guy was still there. And he had a whole bunch of new books, and I picked out a whole bunch of really nice Silver Age Superman stuff. I forget what all I had, but I had a nice little stack of books that, going by the cover price on them, was right around 40 bucks, I think, something like that. And I asked him, I said, do you still happen to have that Detective 400? And he's like, well, I don't know. And he digs out the box. He lets me dig back through. And sure enough, he still had that Detective 400. So I threw it on the stack and I said, be kind to me, make me a good offer, and I'd like to take that book. He looks the whole stack over. And he goes, how about 100 for the whole stack? I'm like, shit. Done. So basically all those other books for free. So yeah, I pulled the trigger on that. So I finally got that book, got to cross that one off my list, but I think as soon as I can and manage to either complete that list of that Batman stuff or get close enough to where it's just about complete, I'm going to start that reading project myself, because I have a lot of those books that you're reading right now that I haven't read in a long, long time. But then a lot of them are on my want list too, you know, the earliest ones. But I was trying to go forward from like Batman, like 200 is the number I decided to go forward on Batman. Like 200 to wherever, whatever number it is where I bailed out. I can't remember what number that was.
I forget the number, but I started with the closing up the Batcave. You know, it's right on the...
Yes, yeah, that's not a bad... Yeah, that's not a bad place to start, because initially that's where I was going to start too, but then I discovered there are a few issues prior to that I wanted to have. Plus, I can't remember who the writer is, but a lot of those issues just prior to where you're talking about are illustrated by Bob Brown. And I have such a fondness for Bob Brown. I know a lot of people find his stuff to be very bland, but his Superboy is my Superboy. And his Batman's not great, but I kind of like it because I can see the Superboy in it, if that makes sense. So I have a fondness for that. And then Detective, I can't remember what number I decided to start with Detective. It's not, I don't think it's very far back from 400, but I can't remember. But between those two titles, I only needed like, I don't know, somewhere between like 30 to 40 books, I think, to fill in like the whole run from where I began collecting. To where I, you know, because I'm not interested at all in going forward from where I quit, but I would like to go back to, right, you know, like a solid start point, other, you know, before I actually began seriously collecting that stuff. But yeah, you've got some good reading coming up in the issues that you're about to get into, because you're going to get into some really good stuff.
You know what is so funny? Batman, when it comes to his dealings with Commissioner Gordon, is... he doesn't speak with one voice, if you know what I mean.
Right.
There's some books where it's, oh, yes, sir, yes, commission. And then others like, are you an idiot? Do you not know what
you... Yeah, it
it's
is.
Like, it's very, oh, Batman's off his medication, this book.
There were a lot of hands in the pot back then, you know, writer-wise. You know, so he, yeah, you're right. He did not really have like a consistent voice for quite a long time, but... You're about to head into some really good stuff. Because have you gotten to like the Bat Murderer story yet and all that? Where no. he's accused of killing Talia al Ghul?
Yes, I did do that, yeah. Yes.
That's where I came in as a kid. That was like the first comic I can ever remember reading. And I think that's why I am to this very day so enamored of Jim Aparo. Because that to me is peak Aparo. I mean, that stuff, he just is delivering some like museum quality art in that stuff. I love that stuff because it's early Aparo, but it's like he's at the peak of his powers, and it's Aparo inking Aparo, which is always best. And I think he might have even colored his own stuff too. I'm not sure. But that is, I mean, that is some beautiful stuff. The only problem with that storyline is that right at the end of it, they switched artists. And I forget who it is, but it's just not near as good. It ends on a thud, unfortunately, artistically anyway. I can't remember how the story is, but artistically.
Creeper becomes a big part of that story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dave, you and I covered some older Batman issues in that era not that long ago. And I think if my memory serves, I think we were gushing over the apparel art in those.
Yes. You would be correct as usual, sir.
I am usually correct, aren't I?
You should, if you're not already, I can't remember if I've seen it in your post or not, but if you're not pairing that with Brave and the Bold, you should.
Oh, really?
I mean, it doesn't.
But that would be the Neil Adams era, wouldn't it?
Tie in. I'm sorry? Say that again?
That would be the Neil Adams Brave and the Bold, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Right around that area, it was Neil Adams. And then when Adams left, for a time, it kind of shifted around different artists, but eventually that becomes Aparo's book. From a certain point, I want to say like 105 or something, from basically like 105 to almost the end of the series. It's almost exclusively Aparo, and damn, is it beautiful stuff. I mean, really good stuff. The only problem is that it doesn't tie into the main titles, which is kind of good in a way because then they're standalone stories.
Right.
But most of that stuff is written by Bob Haney, and it's wacky shit. So you've got him like, you know, his bat sense is tingling and weird shit like that because he just made shit up on the fly. He didn't care at all about continuity. But artistically,
well, Dave and I covered the issue with Commandy on there, and it's like,
Commandy
came to our time, and
Sergeant Rock wasn't Sergeant Rock teamed up?
And, Batman,
I think,
and Batman was teamed
with Rock more than anybody else, I think.
Issue we covered, this flashback. In the issue we covered, there's a flashback, and they have him, you know. Current day, which I guess is like mid-1970s, and he's flashing back to whatever, 1942, 1943, when he was a teenager. Really? He was a teenager 30 years ago. So this is like 50-year-old Batman.
And then in other stories, in the same exact title by the same exact writer, he and Rock are contemporaries that actually fought together in World War II. So like I say, I mean, that's the fun thing about Bob Haney, though, is he just did not give a shit, man. He just wrote stories, you know, and he didn't care if it matched up with anything. He didn't care if it contradicted anything else. He just wrote it
because this is when they were writing these stories for people who were probably 12, 13 years old. That was their target audience. And when you were 12 or 13 years old, if they asked you to write a story, you'd be like, okay, you know, I'm going to have Batman team up with Moses. You know what I mean?
Right. I think you wouldn't give any thought to that. I think that's the appeal. I think that's what made that title magic was that approach, you know, that because it did. It really spoke to kids my age that, for lack of a better term, didn't know any better. You know, the same kids that were playing with, you know, their Superman and Captain America Mego figures together, not realizing these are two completely different companies these characters would never meet, you know, and that's the kind of stuff he was writing in Brave and the Bold. And I think that's what made it magic.
Yeah. I'm going to have to add that in.
And, you know, factor in the fact that when we read this stuff, as much as we enjoy it, we are going to our inner child. There's a level of arrested development that we're reliving being, you know, a young teen as we're reading some of these books. You know, you want it to be sophisticated to the point where, you know, as an adult, you're reading it, and you appreciate the narrative and the storyline, but you still want to have, you know, Batman punching somebody in the face, you know, which is, you know, your teenage fantasies.
That's what I love about the medium. You know, that's what I love about comics is that you can have it all in that regard. You know, you can read something that has real meat that feels like, you know, I say this in air quotes, but it feels like, you know, a legitimate art form. And then you can read some goofy ass Superboy story that makes absolutely no goddamn sense, but it feeds your inner child because you remembered things like that when you were a kid, you know, goofy stories that were just fun. And I love stuff like that. There's one I'm dying to bring to the show. I'm going to have to sit down and get a synopsis written up on it. But I'm curious, Dave, have you ever read this one? It was called The House Where Superboy Grew Up.
I don't think I've read that one. No.
So let me ask you, what is the plot? What is the threat in the movie Avengers Age of Ultron? What is the threat in that movie?
AI.
Now, beyond the AI, what's the AI doing? Like at the big conclusion of the movie, what's the threat?
He's going to wipe out the Earth by dropping the city down, right?
Yes. Yes. So the house where Superboy grows up, the story starts with Superboy's hometown from Krypton landing just outside of Smallville.
Stop.
And like it becomes a tourist attraction where everybody can go visit it except Superboy because it's made of kryptonite. And I'm like, if a goddamn city fell out of the sky from another solar system, wouldn't that annihilate the human race?
I would think so.
And that's how the story starts. Is it literally, you see,
you'd probably barely have any repercussions at all.
What's that? What'd you say, Paul?
So you probably have no repercussions at all. I would probably sleep through it.
it literally lands outside. It just says, whoop. I love stuff like this. I mean, this is the sort of stuff I love discovering, stories like that where you know, you can read it, you can love it, you can enjoy it, but then you also have to sit back and go,
what the?
I mean, what?
Well, listen to this. I've talked about that. Go ahead, Dave.
I just finished the arc in the Batman comics about the Crime Olympics of 1976. And the final scene in the book, you know, Batman cracks the whole case and he drops a dime to the police. And it ends with whoever's running this criminal Olympics calling Commissioner Gordon saying, oh, our Olympics is done. You know, we're out of here. You're never going to, you know, catch us. And Gordon's, you see him going, yeah, why don't you try looking out the window? And like it pulls back and it shows like 400 police cars with the lights flash. And all I kept thinking is the guy who wrote the end of Die Hard 3 read this. Because that's exactly how the movie ends.
You're right. I love it. I wish I was reading more right now. I have been a comics buying fool. They had a brand new, like one of those local one-day cons here in town recently that I went to just to kind of check it out. And it turned out it was fantastic. It was a really good, I mean, lots of really good deals. I cleaned up on like Jimmy Olsen, Lois Lane, all that Silver Age Superman family stuff that I've been chasing on the cheap. There was a guy there that had, I mean, I don't know how many long boxes full of that stuff. Three bucks a pop for those books. Really? And I mean, they're in sweet condition. So I got a bunch of that. I mean, stuff all over the place. A lot of, you know, filling in holes and everything. But, some really good stuff. And then there's another one even closer to me coming up this weekend that I'm going to go check out. So, yeah, there's been a lot of, just those small. And that's been my thing lately is I have found that I enjoy those little pop-up cons like that so much more than like the big. I'm done with like MegaCon and those big ones because they're so disappointing, you know. They're all focused on anime and
Funko Pop. What about Heroes Con?
Oh, I'm definitely going to go to that, but I mean that the reason to go to that one, you know, so I've been told, is that it's still comics, you know. It's a comics focus, so it's not all, you know, this other distracting crap that, you know, the big cons have all turned into. Because I'm still, I mean, if I'm going to something like that, I'm going to chase back issues. I don't give a damn if, you know, the third stormtrooper from the left is appearing and signing, you know, autographs. I don't give a shit about any of that stuff. And God, I went to MegaCon with a couple celebrities in mind, and they were charging such ridiculous prices. It was one of those where you just look at them and go, Who do you think you are exactly that you're charging that price? You know, you're not Sir Laurence Olivier, you know? I mean, they had, help me out, Dave. Who's the guy that voiced Superman in Superman the Animated? Tim Daly? Is that his name?
Yes, Tim Daly. Yeah.
He was at MegaCon. I was so jazzed to go meet him. And he was charging, I mean, just stupid prices just to go up and talk to him. And I'm like, no, I'm sorry, dude. I think you're cool, but no. So yeah, I'm done with the big ones. Like I say, for me, it's all about the comic stuff. And the comics, you know, I want to meet the comic celebrities. I, you know, not movie stars or TV stars. I want to meet, you know, the guys that drew and wrote these things, you know.
Some of these people aren't even working. And they're charging astronomical. I get maybe this is how they supplement their income, but you're not John Wayne.
I agree. I didn't mind it so much when you paid that money for, you know, when you paid
still recording?
Money. Yeah. Yes, okay. We are.
It just went weird there for a second.
But I didn't mind paying money when I thought the money wasn't outrageous. It was still, it wasn't like it was cheap. But, you know, like when it was pay $20 and take a photo op with Henry Winkler, pay $20 and, or it was, I think it was $10 for a photo op with Eric Roberts. I did those things and I enjoy it. I have the pictures and I think it's pretty cool. But when it starts being, you know, pay $500 for a picture with so-and-so, you know what? I don't care. I remember when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and we were talking about going to concerts and how much tickets cost back then, which compared to now is virtually nothing. But I remember my friend's mother saying, I don't care if they have Jesus Christ live on stage. I'm not paying that kind of money to see it. And that's the way I feel about some of these photo ops now.
Well, for a screwing like that, they should buy you dinner first.
Absolutely. At least kiss you.
I don't know. I mean, I know it makes me sound, I don't know, whatever, but I always think back to, I remember being at a convention when I was a kid, because I used to go to like the Ithacons and stuff that were, you know, relatively close to me as a kid. And Roger Stern was almost always at the conventions that I would go to. And I remember somebody asking him one time why he didn't, because this was just when people were starting to charge for autographs, especially if you walked up and just dumped like a stack of books on them. Then they would be like, okay, you know, the first three or four are free, but after that it's, you know, $1 a piece or whatever. And I remember one time somebody doing that to Stern, and he just sat there and he signed them. And I had done that a few times myself. I mean, not with a massive stack of stuff, but I mean a pretty decent stack. But I always was like, you know, I'd present the stack and be like, hey, you know, could you pick out one or two that, you know, that means something to you, and, you know, sign it. And he would sit there, and before I knew it, he'd sign them all. And I remember somebody asking him one time why he didn't charge. And he said, you know, the biggest reason I don't charge, and he points at the exit. He goes, if I walk out that door and go across the street to the McDonald's, nobody over there is going to know who the hell that I am. He goes, so why should I sit here and charge somebody money, you know, for my autograph that in his opinion was basically worthless, because who was he? And I was like, why don't more of them have that attitude? Because they all want to act like they're Stan Lee. I mean, beyond Stan Lee, I would challenge you to find a man in the street that can name you the name of a, you know, of a comics celebrity or, you know, a comics creator. Who does Joe Average on the street know beyond Stan Lee? So these guys charging these prices.
Maybe Bob Kane.
Maybe. Yeah, it's crazy.
I that was one of the things that I used to talk about at New York Comic Con, and you know, it's like, in here, Neil Adams is God. Walk across the street, people don't know who he is.
Exactly.
And it was borne out. It was borne out when I got to know Jimmy Palmiotti a little bit, not very well, but a little bit, so that he actually would. I don't think he knew me by name, but if he saw me, he recognized my face.
Right.
And you know, I saw him a couple of times at New York Comic Con and talked to him, and you know, he was very cool. And then one time, I think, Dave, I might have been with you. I was either with you or with Ian Levenstein. And we were walking away from the con, and Jimmy was across the street with his wife, Amanda, and they were just sitting, and like, nobody was even coming over and talking to them. And I said something about, like, out here, people don't know who you are. And he left, and he was like, yeah, out here, I can just hang out. Over there, I have a big crowd around me. And it's the reality of it. You know, it is a niche celebrity.
Right.
And it's cool, you know. I mean, it's I'm very cool with that, but you know, don't think that, you know, don't get too much of a swollen head over it. And you know, to some extent, I even feel that with the podcasting stuff. Like, you know, we enjoy doing this, and we had a little announcement at the beginning of the episode as to what we're doing and all of that. But we said quite a while ago that if it ever got to the point where we have to monetize this, we're walking away.
Right.
But you see some of these podcasts where like their whole focus is, oh, you know, you need to donate money to the show, or you're not going to get the episodes. You know, I don't want to blast anybody, because, you know, you do what you want to do. But like there's a podcast out there that I listened to for a little while, Marvel by the Month. And they started from, you know, Fantastic Four number one, and they were working through. And eventually it got to the point of, well, We're gonna cover every issue that came out these months, but we're only presenting these six issues for free, and the other ones you have to subscribe if you want them. And it's like, you know what? I don't need any of your show anymore.
So that's only a six-issue show, is what you're saying.
I'm saying it's just, you know, like I said, you know what? You want to do it, if you can make money that way, if people are willing to pay it, more power to you. But I'm not willing to. I'm not interested. And I'm not asking other people to pay us to do this. You know what I find more offensive than that?
With the celebrities, not so much the comic ones, but like the photo op type thing. Because we did that. I did that with the kids. They used to have a small con that I think was tied directly into those CW programs, because it was basically all those people. And we went and
I think Steve Amell had a lot to do with setting that up.
Probably.
Steve Amell, who played the Green Arrow.
Right. And we got a photo op with him, and we got a photo op with Daniel Panabaker. But they were all nice.
You know what I mean? Pescarilla.
Yes. But one of them, the one who played the Black Canary, she was like a dick, to be honest with you. You know, if someone's paying you to take a picture, you can at least smile and be polite.
Right.
Like Katie Cassidy.
Was that David Cassidy's daughter?
I don't know.
David maybe. Cassidy of Partridge Family fame. I think that's his daughter.
But everybody else, Stephen Amell was particularly like with the kids. He was like really like nice. Oh, it's so great to see. I'm so glad you came. Just that, you know, no people one are paying you. You could at least be polite. I'm not saying.
Right.
No one has ever been nicer when we went to do a photo op than Henry Winkler was. He was talking to us. He was very, you know, just unassuming. And then when I went to pay for the photo op, he waved his hand like, you know what? You don't have to pay. I mean, it was just an incredible experience. It was just, you know, the nicest guy that you could possibly imagine. You know, you hate when you meet somebody who you have enjoyed their work and they turn out to be an ass. But when you meet them and they turn out to be really cool, it makes up for all of that.
Definitely.
I always say the guy who got criticized a lot because of his ego was Neil Adams. And that was one of the best experiences I ever had. It was when New York Comic Con first added Thursday, and you could only go Thursday if you had a four-day ticket. You couldn't buy Thursday as a single ticket. So it was by far the least crowded day. And at the time, I had been given a press pass for the show, which was amazing. But I got there, and there was nobody at Neil Adams' table. And I sat down, and I talked to him for about 20 minutes, and he couldn't have been nicer. We took a picture together. I bought a print that he signed for me. We talked about, like, when I tried to draw pictures and when I tried to copy pictures from him. And he had, you know, it was just like one of the best experiences. And so when people say, oh, I don't like Neil Adams, he had a big ego. You know what? Too bad. He was great to me. End of story.
And then when you were leaving, you said, and what was your name again?
You know, the only thing that amazed me was how much Neil Adams charged for a commission.
What did he that charge was for a commission?
A phenomenal amount of money. I don't even remember exactly. I think it was like for just like a little small postcard sized head sketch, it was like $250 or some crazy wow. amount like that. And that was this, we're talking, you know, 10, 11 years ago. You know, wow. Obviously, Neil passed away, so he wouldn't be doing that any longer, but I assume. You know, the key artists out there who do commissions have probably upped their prices over the years anyway.
Well, you know, he had a gift, so.
Oh, absolutely. He was one of the most talented guys. And I would recommend, I'm not a huge fan of word balloon, just because sometimes it feels a little indulgent. But if you ever listen to the podcast when Neil Adams was on, It was definitely a worthwhile experience. I enjoyed listening to him pontificate about all the different things that he would talk about, and some of which you would say, well, you know, that's a little ridiculous or whatever. But it was still fun to listen to him talk about it and justify it. And he always looked out for other people. He was one of the big guys to get Simon & Schuster money for creating Superman. And, you know, he was a big creator rights guy, and I don't think he needed to do it to line his own wallet. I think he was doing quite well for himself anyway. So I think he was doing that for everybody else.
So he was a stand-up guy.
Needless to say, I'm a huge Neil Adams fan, and I always will be. And that's why some of the issues on my want list are on there. I added, you know, the Green Lantern, Green Arrow, Neil Adams, Denny O'Neill issues onto my want list just because of Neil Adams. Because when you read those, quite frankly, the Denny O'Neill dialogue is a bit dated and some of it's like a little silly, but the artwork is just amazing.
Yeah, because I think you had commented on it. I just finally acquired, where the hell is it? I got it in the stack right here.
Yeah, I saw it posted on Facebook. That's an amazing find. I have yet to get that one.
Yeah, it's there it is. Green Lantern, Green Arrow, number 76. Nice. I've only been chasing that my entire goddamn life. Finally got that. And I think I had forgotten that. I mean, I got it for the art. Now, not that I like Denny O'Neill. I respect Denny O'Neill a lot. I like a lot of his stories. Not a big fan of his Green Lantern stuff, honestly. So it's one of those like, well, what the hell did you buy it for? I bought it purely for, that's the only reason I bought that entire run was the Neil Adams art. The Neil Adams art is absolutely top notch. But the stories, because that's the one where Green Lantern and Green Arrow are talking and the black guy walks up to him and is basically like, what the hell have you ever done for the black man? And I so badly wanted to do like an editor's version or something for this, like a recut where he's like, I have saved the entire goddamn planet. How many times? You live here, right? But
hey, remember that time the planet was going to be destroyed?
Yeah. I mean, and he literally hangs his head in shame. And that's the whole beginning of the hard traveling heroes thing, which there was some good stuff in there. But I'm like, dude, why are you hanging your head? Why are you feeling this guilt that you is totally undeserved? Because, you know, what do you mean, what have I done for the Black? I've saved the world umpteen times by this point, you know? I mean, it galls me every time I read it. I'm like, that is the stupidest story. Why did nobody ever call him on it? But I don't know. But the art, the art is fantastic. It's really, really good. But, you know, it's weird in that, and I think we may have talked about this, I can't remember, but I've often wondered if you took those same stories that are so lauded and so highly regarded and have become classic stories by Denny O'Neil, and if they were illustrated by basically anybody else, would they have that status? And I seriously doubt it. I think a lot of the reason those stories are so held up is the Neil Adams art in so many regards.
I totally agree.
Every single story, of course, but I would say the vast majority of them, because a lot of them, yeah, they don't really hold up all that well. I mean, prime example is, I can't remember the issue number, but one I have loved since I was a kid. It is still one of my favorite Batman stories. It's an issue of Detective. I can't remember the number, but it's the one where Robin basically turns to sand on the cover as Batman's holding him in his arms. He's saying something like, "Robin, what's happening to you?" while Robin basically just evaporates. And you read that story, it doesn't make a lick of fucking sense. Not at all. I mean, when you really examine the story, but visually, it's an awesome story. And so I can't help but wonder if that had been illustrated, and this is not to denigrate any other artists, because I respect these guys, but if it had been illustrated by, say, Irv Novik or Carmen Infantino or, you know, any of the other guys that were doing, Bob Brown, you know, any of the other guys that were doing Batman at the exact same time, I think it would just be another issue, you know? It would just be another issue that people don't, you know, it doesn't command prices. People aren't seeking it out. It's just another issue of Batman. But it's because...
How many times...
Neil Adams.
Sorry. How many times have you wanted to get an issue because you saw it over the years with the Neil Adams cover, and then you finally acquire it, and the inside is drawn by Kurt Swan or somebody else, and you're like, but this doesn't compare to the cover.
Right.
You know, it's like, I wouldn't have bought this if I knew the inside looked like this.
Well, I mean,
and that's not to denigrate Kurt Swan, because he was my Superman artist when I was growing up. He was Superman artist for many people growing up, because he did it for years and years and years. And I, you know, I enjoy Kurt Swan's work, but he doesn't, you know, Kurt Swan on his best day is not Neil Adams.
Right. But I think that, I mean, I think that's the reason why Adams did so many covers, you know, over, you know, that period of DC, especially. I mean, I look at that era when he was doing like the Superboy covers. I mean, just some absolutely stunning covers, and not, you know, not that the interior art wasn't, you know, wasn't any good or whatever, but it's just, it wasn't Neil Adams. And so I think he was brought in to prop up a number of books, you know, in that regard. But yeah, I mean, that lends right into, and I mean, I've been beat up for this so many times, I don't even care anymore, but that lends into, you know, that frustration I had as a young person getting into comics and starting to read and collect comics, of why I found Superman so hard to get into when I really wanted to be a Superman fan. I really wanted to be reading and enjoying Superman, but I would pick up an issue that had an absolutely stunning cover on it by Adams or by Rich Buckler or Garcia Lopez or any of these, you know, fantastic artists that really did, you know, dynamic things and, you know, had, you know, really good looking figure work on the kind of really tight anatomy and, you know, just really heroic posing. And you'd open it up and it would be bland old Kurt Swan. And I was like, damn it. You know, and that happened for years. That's why I was so excited when Byrne finally got the job to come in and reinvigorate the character, because he wasn't just doing covers. You know, he was doing the whole thing and it looked really good. But I don't know. I mean, I've been blasted for that. So, Kurt Swan was, well, I'm not saying Kurt Swan was bad. It's just by a point when you've got, I mean, obviously DC knew. They had to have known. If you're putting Neil Adams on the cover to sell the book, then that tells me you know that your interior guy ain't doing the job anymore to sell the book. You know what I mean? He's doing the story, but if you're that confident in your guy, then why isn't your guy doing the cover? And he wasn't doing covers by that point.
Well, there also becomes a point in time with those Superman books where it's like, oh, let's just clear out the back inventory. We're going to wrap this up soon.
Yep.
Oh, brilliant idea. Just throw
that there. You could see that at the end. Yeah. Yeah, right at the end before whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow. I mean, you could see that. They were clearing out the inventory drawer and a lot of that stuff. I mean, not that there wasn't good stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's the shame, too. It always makes me nuts when you've got a writer that comes in and they're really giving it their all, but they're saddled with somebody that's just not doing them any justice. I have tried so hard to really get into and really appreciate like Marv Wolfman's run on Superman towards the end of, you know, Silver Age Superman before the Byrne reboot. And there's some really good stories and really good ideas and things in there, but he's saddled with Kurt Swan, who by that point he was just mailing in mailing in his work. You know, he wasn't giving it his all. And I mean, people can make every argument they want and they can get pissed at me for saying it, but the simple fact of the matter was the guy overstayed his welcome by about 20 years, unfortunately, because much beyond, I would say, the early 80s, there was no dynamism left in that stuff. Was he a great Superman artist back in his day? Hell yeah. When I was a kid in the early 70s, I mean, and he was being inked by like Ochsner or Murphy Anderson. I mean, yeah, it was dynamic. It was, I would say it would hold toe to toe with something like Neil Adams, but by the mid 80s,
I don't remember who the inker was. But Dave and I covered the issue of Superman with the
233,
the beginning of Kryptonite No More. Kryptonite
Nevermore.
Murphy Anderson.
233.
And Murphy Anderson did it, and we were fawning very much over the Kurt Swan art.
It's beautiful
because it was inked, really well. It was definitely trying to get a Neil Adams look about it,
right?
But no, it was fairly successful in kind of creating something akin to it. It was not Neil Adams, but it was, you know, it was good enough to get us excited about it.
You look at that, and then you look at, say, whatever the last issue Swan did before the end, before whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow. I couldn't tell you what issue number that is, but you look at that issue, whatever issue that is, and just look at the difference. And I mean, everybody ages, I get that, you know, but I don't think it was entirely age. I think a lot of it was just, I think the passion was just gone. It was just by rote at that point. The dynamism was gone, and that was my issue, is that, okay, you were great once, but how long can you coast, you know, on that reputation? And I don't understand why in a hobby like this, where everybody has such strong, passionate opinions on things, he continues to get a pass all these years later on being so slack at the very end of his career. I've never understood that. I never will understand that. And so it's always kind of bothered me that I've taken such shit about pointing it out when it's true. And I'm not saying it because I hate the guy. I'm saying that because I really enjoyed his stuff when I was a kid, but he just he overstayed his welcome by by quite a margin. He just wasn't bringing his A game. And I mean, you're talking about the biggest character in comics, the most important character in comics. He should have somebody on there that's contemporary, current, popular, and bringing his A game, not somebody that's been on the book for 40 friggin' years that just doesn't care anymore.
You know, it's like that, though. It's in every profession. From that, comics to politics, people never know when to pack it in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I've often wondered what the deal was where he was allowed to do that when so many other artists by that point that had been around, as long or longer, were struggling to find work. Yet he just stuck with selling. I don't know.
That was what I was just going to say. My guess on that is that the book was still among the top sellers, and they thought, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right. That had to be it. Because there was a period where Superman sold pretty much regardless. I mean, it maintained being a top seller for a long, long time. But I don't know. I don't know. I'd love to know, when did it turn a corner enough to where they greenlit the Byrne reboot? How did all that come about? That's a story I honestly don't know. I'd be very curious to know.
It was the story where Clark Kent really was a homely guy who was, focusing mental waves to make people think he looked different than Superman.
Well, all these years I've made people think that I'm homely and I'm really, quite good looking.
Which makes you wonder what Lana Lang was thinking, eh?
Well, have we exhausted this topic for tonight?
I think so.
I think I'm tired. I'm an old man and I'm tired. Get off my freaking lawn. But I'm happy, just to kind of bring it full circle to where we came in. Like I said, we've had some issues or whatever with just trying to get the time to record, getting to get up to record and do everything. But we haven't lost our passion for the hobby. We haven't lost our passion for talking to each other and going through these books. We hope that the listeners haven't lost their level of enjoyment in listening to us. So, like I said, we're going to pull back on the reins a little bit. We're going to go for an every other week new episode instead of every week. But, the feed will continue to have an episode every week with, classic episodes being reposted. And I don't remember if that was in our discussion between ourselves or if it was part of the discussion at the beginning of the show. But, since we had some issues with the website, a lot of people, a lot of episodes have not shown up on Apple Music and Spotify and all those different sites. So this could be the only source other than the actual website to get these episodes. Certainly to get it on your phone, it may be the easiest way to do it. So hopefully you'll enjoy listening to some of the older episodes. Again, I don't know if I'm going to post, every episode. I'm going to start at the beginning and work our way through a few before we start skipping anything. But I'll try and listen to them. And if there's audio issues or if there's just, a bad episode here and there, which I can't imagine we ever made a bad episode, but that's besides the point. I may skip and just kind of pick the best of Back to the Bins, but at least in the beginning, I'm going to start going through. And I didn't come on this, I think, until episode 86. So there's a good chance there's 85 good episodes before I got here anyway. So everybody, thank you for listening. Thank you for staying with us and have a good night. And we'll see you next. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook.
Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.